This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The Universal Periodic Review, or UPR, is a United Nations process where each member country's performance on human rights is assessed by their peers. Every 5 years, the Human Rights Council assesses a country's progress towards fulfilling their commitments to basic freedoms, regardless of race, gender, and religion. Civil societies are encouraged to take part in the process, and in Malaysia, Kemango, a coalition of Malaysian NGOs, has been involved since 2009. With 2 years to go before Malaysia's next review, Kemango spokesperson Gerald Joseph joins me in the studio to explain what their midterm report is for Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Gerald.
Thank you. Thanks for welcoming us.
Based on the report, what has Kemango concluded about the current state of human rights in Malaysia?
I think even without the report, the conclusion would be the same. We are regressing in terms of human rights, and we were hoping that some of the international standing of Malaysia as a respected member of the diplomatic United Nations Corps would help Malaysia towards complying with some minimum standards. But as you know, the last few years, things have been going downstream in many aspects. So I think this coalition called Coalition for Malaysian NGOs for UPR, about 54 NGOs, our task was to monitor, because it's an open process, and we are the space where now we have checked some of the government's agreed commitments via the process is that other governments give them recommendations and they have a choice to reject or accept. So whatever they've accepted is what we are really monitoring, and that's what we're going to talk about later. Yeah.
This midterm UPR is not compulsory, but Suhakam has stated they'll be working on a midterm report as well. Are NGOs involved in the process of Suhakam's report?
Yes, Suhakam has always been open to invite other stakeholders, and NGOs are involved. They've called us to get our feedback, to have a discussion with us, although the report will be solely their report, but they have done that already. But the government, you're right, has decided not to submit a midterm review report because it's not mandatory in the system. It's encouraged by the UN. Some governments have done it, but Malaysia has not done it. But we were informed by Wisma Putra that though they're not doing it, but they are still collating information on the progress of all the agencies who are involved in the different sectors of the report. Yeah.
Considering this is something the government did not do, why was it that Kemango felt that it would be good to have this sort of midterm review? Is it just good to have periodic checks?
I think if we are serious about this a review mechanism, then I think if we do it every year, it probably helps us when we come to the end of the 5 years in 2018 when Malaysia is up for review. We will be able to also have enough information and input for ourselves. But having said that, I think it's incumbent upon the government of the day to take monitoring seriously. And that's, I think, a big question mark for us. You know, a lot of pronouncements are made in Geneva and New York at the UN. But what's happening at home, you know, who's monitoring those speeches and what's done? So I think a midterm review, although it takes a lot of energy and time, I think is something we thought was a good idea by the UN.
In the report, there are mentions of 6 core international conventions that are concerned with political rights, social rights, racial discrimination, torture, migrant worker rights, and enforced disappearance. Is Malaysia party to these conventions?
Actually, it's considered the 9 core human rights international treaties. Malaysia have ratified 3 of them. The word ratify means they agree to comply to that international standard. So that's CEDAW, which is a convention on against discrimination of women, the Child Rights Convention, and the most recent is the Convention on People with Disability. But these are the conventions that are most signed by all countries in the world. Then it brings us back to Malaysia, which has very high standing. It's considered almost a developed nation, but yet the older core treaties of human rights, the 6 that you've mentioned, some of them like civil political conventions against torture, racial discrimination, economic, social, cultural rights. These covenants have been signed by many governments, including in the region. No? Singapore recently has signed the convention against for the elimination of racial discrimination just end of last year. But Malaysia is still part of 15 that have not signed, 15 including Brunei, North Korea, Myanmar, and you know, the list can go on. It's not a very good party to be in, but Malaysia, sadly, is still there. And Convention Against Torture. So we ask, if the government doesn't want to ratify, what is it telling the world? We are okay with torture? We are okay with racial discrimination?
Why? What is standing in the way of us ratifying this?
Actually, they are not telling us as straight as can be, but our guess is there are some agencies in the government, mainly, I think, Home Affairs Ministry, maybe Jabatan Islam, who have some fears about the position of our constitution in terms of religion or affirmative action. And we said, actually, those things can be managed when you discuss with the different covenants, you know, because there are some room for calling for reservation, that you can work at it. And also, affirmative action is not really anti-human rights. It has a way that it must be viewed in human rights. So I think people, including us, are willing to sit down with governments to find ways for our ratification. But the common answer is the Attorney General's Chamber's classic answer is, which I think is an absolute delaying tactic, is saying that we will only sign when we are absolutely ready, and we will never be ready because no nation is ever ready for human rights. There was a logic of having a covenant to encourage governments towards compliance in sort of a due time, you know. But Malaysia government is saying no to this, but it ratified the other covenants immediately and then changed practice and law, which is the common logic of international law. So for women, child rights, and people with disability, it's signed first and then work towards changing our practice, but not for the others. And we're asking why. Obviously, because they don't want to.
With the others, then, the aim is, let's get to the point where we would already comply and then we'll sign just to say we've done it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
yeah. There is also a little bit of disparity in terms of freedom of assembly. Kamango's report stated that freedom of assembly is facing a regression here. Basu Hakam's annual report commended the progress of freedom of assembly rights as practiced by Malaysians and supported by authorities. Why this disparity in view?
I think it's, if you see it as black and white, then yeah, it looks different. But I think it's sort of a progression of changes. So the NGOs in Malaysia, including Kumango, has always said we are good to have a new law, Public Assembly Bill. But what does that mean when you can do a demonstration and after that you're charged? Using technicalities, you know, for either you what for I think the Bursay leaders was DBKL charged them for damage of property and flower pot. So you find different ways to come back while promoting your freedom of assembly. So we know no freedom of assembly is ever absolute, but if the essence of freedom of assembly, which the courts are trying to now interpret, is to say that people have that freedom and do not threaten this via post-assembly using of the law to clamp down. So I think that's our take on this. So I think Suhakam is looking at the original intent, which is a positive move, but we are already looking at the present practice where a few of the leaders always get called up or charged in court.
Has there been a change in attitude amongst members of authority when it comes to the right to public assembly? Because as you rightly point out, it's one thing to pass laws. It's another thing to actually put these things in practice. It's another thing to what you actually say about assembly.
I think there's a disjoint between the political rhetoric and selling of we have new laws, good laws, and we always celebrate when there's a good law in the country, including this Freedom of Assembly Act. But the intent, I think, has not gone down because an example is you still hear top police officers in KL or Selangor saying that no permit has been issued and, you know, this rally is illegal or that rally is illegal. But there's no such concept of a permit anymore in the new Public Assembly Act. So you're wondering how come the very law enforcement officers are still using the old language, which predates this law, where you need permit. So even when we did the ASEAN People's Forum last year, we gave them the 10-day notice. Everything was okay. But yet, the police chief, when interviewed, said that no permit was given. So I think that's the disjoint, and I think authorities are still quite regressive towards giving more rights to people, and so they're using the old frameworks.
I'm speaking today with Gerald Joseph, Comango's spokesperson, and we're talking about Comango's Universal Periodic Review midterm report. In other words, we're looking at where we stand on human rights in the country, you know, 2 years on since we decided that we were going to do this. Now, up next, we'll talk a little bit more about the Sedition Act, as well as press freedom, all big issues here in our country. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Gerald Joseph, spokesperson for Comango, which you might recall is a coalition of Malaysian NGOs. And we're talking about Comango's Universal Periodic Review midterm report, or a midterm report on the state of human rights in our country. Now, what is your concern with the Sedition Act 1948? I feel like we talk about this act a lot, but we continue to have to.
Yep. I think if you have to refer to 1948, it already gives the answer. It doesn't speak well of a law that is not in line with what it was, came out in a different period, during a different era of Malaysians' politics, and during a different administration, and not this government. But yet it's been amended to strengthen it more. So Malaysia cannot pretend to be defending freedom of expression, human rights, and then using its very own power to curtail it via the Sedition Act. And you and I know that there's been so many more arrests on dissent, politicians, NGO activists, and individuals, in the name of sedition, and it gives too much of power and breadth to the enforcement authorities to decide what law you have done. So on that instant, I think they have probably also failed in their one of the agreed recommendations the government has agreed at the UPR was to to repeal the Sedition Act. So in 2013, they agreed they were going to repeal, but now they've strengthened it even more. So that's really a disaster in terms of the growth of human rights in Malaysia.
The counterpoint or the counter-argument to the Sedition Act is always the idea that, well, freedom of expression is good, but too much freedom of expression is not. You know, from the point of view of civil societies, of NGOs, make the case for freedom of expression.
So freedom of expression is too much or too little based on who what decides. I mean, the only question is who are the guardians of expression. If you look at the internet space now, I mean, everybody at this point, as you're talking, I don't know what they're thinking of both of us, you know. They're probably either loving us or hating us. But that's fine. We are still here. We're still talking. So who determines that what they are doing is detrimental to our well-being and the well-being of the nation? So I think to learn from other countries where there's more freedom of expression, it has actually encouraged greater participation and involvement in society and the growth of the nation. So if we take a more regressive example of countries who are too limiting and stifling. Is there really no data to show that by doing that, your nation has grown both as a society, people, as well as developmentally? So I really have found no compelling argument from the government side why we need to stifle. I think the only reason government needs to get on board is that if you have decided to say yes to be the government of the day, which is a voluntary thing anyway, then get on with your duty, which means you have obligations to the people. And if the people is saying you're good, they love when you praise them and lift them high, which rightfully sometimes they deserve it. But in the same stroke of the same pen, you could also tell them, hey, you've not done well in many things. And you cannot take it personally. And the government should say thank you to us for doing them a favor, for pointing out what is wrong. You know? And I think that only happens if freedom of expression is respected.
When it comes to freedom of expression, we can't also escape from talking about press freedom. Mm-hmm. What is the state of press freedom?
Well, I'm here in BFM studio, so you know more than I the repressions you had to handle. So like your station and others, I think the state of media, both mainstream print media, online media, is that the inability to actually speak to truth in an open way. You know, I think truth is subjective, but the very fact that it must be challenged in an open manner and all sides can come forward must be allowed and respected and protected. But when that space is not allowed, and that's where we are here, monitoring Malaysians' human rights compliance, because that compliance is not respected at all. No? The government does not think that citizens, as well as media agencies like yourself, has the right to speak freely, you know. And that's where they come and tell you should not meddle on this. This is either against a court case being discussed, or it's against the detrimental of democracy, which is, you know, now they use Penal Code 124B to say that, you know, anything is detriment to democracy. So what does it mean? So who decides what is good? So I think if we want a vibrant nation, then the media should be the most important institution, apart from government and people, to ensure that that debate allows people to have both view. And today, you know, the Sarawak election most recently, the media was only spewing all good things on one side and a lot of negative things on the opposition. So even when you look at elections, we are really flawed because the media is not the defender of an open space. We are in serious trouble if this nation wants to get a developed nation status. Business cannot thrive if the media is not free, no? Because business needs to know that its evaluation is based on merit, not propaganda.
Earlier we talked about those nine core conventions, human rights conventions, and we've ratified three, one of which, as you said, is CEDAW, right? And looking at women's rights, Komango's report stated that despite the government fully implementing national awareness programs regarding violence against women, there has been minimal progress here. Why is the progress slow?
I think the short answer is that the progress is slow, and on human rights is because the government needs to to take on board that human rights is a good thing for the nation. That's the short answer. The long answer is then the agencies implementing will need to also be more human rights compliant and human rights based. I think on the issue of women, I think though Domestic Violence Act has been around for so many years, I think 20 over years in Malaysia, but it's still something that people can get away with, you know, both from society's point of view. And this is a violation that you don't blame the government, because it's a third-party violator. It could be the husband, the man, or sometimes a woman for children, you know. It's a third-party violator. The government is not the violator of rights in this instance, but the government has a duty to protect when such violations happen. That's where we call on the government through its agencies, through police, to come on board. And I think the training that many NGOs and Women's Ministry have done to make sure that the enforcement agencies are quick to respond to this really is not moving fast, because culturally we are still quite stuck in our patriarchal and feudal mentality, you know, that, these things will work itself out. I mean, the husband and wife will sort itself out, but many times it doesn't. And women mainly suffer at the hands of men. So I think a retraining of the whole enforcement system will only work if the government of the day is actually loudly proclaiming and believing that human rights works for society.
Aside from violence, what other aspects of women's rights are you concerned about?
On women's rights, I think apart from violence, there is also there's a whole list. You know, there's also early child marriages. There was an issue that was brought up. There's also issue of the whole gray area of marital rape. You know, that is still not so easy to discuss. There's also the issue of sexual harassment. We don't have a Sexual Harassment Act, and you saw the conduct of parliamentarians appalling, that they can still think like that despite wearing such beautiful coat, tie, and, you know, clothes. So I think the nation has regressed, even in that sense of the education level has not translated to basic respect of both men and women and equality amongst gender. So I think there's a whole host of things that need to be done. But also I think it's complicated, because then you have issues of religion. But I don't think per se any religion will condone any sort of violence. So I think we need to appeal to that side of all religions for compassion as a response to violence.
Back in March, amendments were made to the Child Act. We were talking about women, now children, including harsher penalties for child abuse. How has this affected the rights of children in Malaysia?
Well, the amendments have come into force, but yet again, then we need to make sure that the ministries, the enforcement agencies, know the roles, the rights, and, you know, any law, the power of law is only as good as people understanding the law and enforcement agencies knowing how the law can be used. So I think one of the roles of the government is to educate Malaysian about our rights through the law. And I think that's the gap that needs to be addressed now. And I think issues of children's rights probably has not gone through the system because there is no human rights education in schools. So Akam has been trying to streamline mainstream human rights education. It started off, I think, the last 10, 20 years. Never was successful. I think at the moment it's still at a pilot project of 10 to 20 schools. And our question is why? Why are we afraid on human rights education for all?
Another important part of, we can't talk about children's rights without talking about this. Has there been progress regarding issues of early and forced marriages?
So as I mentioned earlier, I think this is still quite a taboo subject. Not much progress really on this, but I think the discussions have started. But I think it comes to the definition of the legal age of a child or adult, you know, with both sides of the coin. So is it 18, 16? So our laws differentiate between women of legal marriage age is 16 and men. So we're saying, can a child have the capacity on his or her own to make those decisions at such a young age? Will that then take away the possibility of the full development of the human person, which is the intent of human rights, if that education disappears because of marriage and childbearing at that young age? So I think the logical response, anybody will know that, hey, delay that, help the child know if you fall in love, and it's always hormones are raging at that age, you know. But we all grew up and we were taught to, okay, you can have your excitement in life, but you must know your responsibility as being preparing yourself for adulthood. And I think that's why this discussion should not be tempered with by using religion and culture, which I think is a detriment to the well-being of children. Because again, I don't think any religion would be counter to the full development of a child. No? So I think, again, this discussion has to take it away from the realm of sensitivity of cultures or religion, but back to the center of what's the best for the child.
Moving on to Indigenous peoples. In the report, there was mention of persistent skepticism about the integrity of the Department of Orang Asli Development in managing the budget allocated for the use of Indigenous peoples. What is the proof and the reasoning behind this statement of skepticism?
Actually, the many coalitions of Orang Asli and Orang Asal, there's one called Jaringan Kampung Orang Asli Semenanjung Malaysia, JKOASM, which is a member of Komango. They have actually, through their experience of working with the government, and the government only works through this department called JAKWA, Jabatan Kemajuan Orang Asli Semenanjung Malaysia, they have realised that huge allocations in the budget. The last 2 years, like this last year, $350 million. So it's like really huge. It sounds big. It's like, wow, for 200,000 Orang Asli, that's not bad. So the initial reaction is that's positive. But then through the year, you never get to find out where the money is used, what's the allocation, how much of money is used for overheads, cost of the personnel, and the actual implementation of development or education. So I think that skepticism has grown out of real experience in engaging with the department. And they have proof. They have proof. You ask a community, they can go and say, we went there, we asked for this. Children, the quality of Orang Asli schools, it's not the best. And we've heard also, remember the story of that 7 kids that disappeared and 5 drowned. So we are reminded, how is that possible for one group of children, the Orang Asli, you know? Is it because it's Orang Asli school that the quality is not maintained like other public schools in Malaysia? So I think you can go through many areas of Orang Asli. You can go to the houses, you can go to the roads, land for them, you know. Why is the... And you and I know that Orang Asli are different from both of us, you know. We'd probably be happy with 1,000 square feet in Kuala Lumpur, say, wow, I have a property, and we celebrate and tell our friends. But for them, that's not the way they live. They would need a forest, not to sell it, but to maintain their lifestyle. But this department is entrusted to ensure that their lands are gazetted and titled for the community. But over the last 60 over years, only 15%, not more than 15% is gazetted. Then you ask, what's the point of having a department entrusted for their welfare when it's not been able to achieve that?
Has the government transformation program affected the lives of Indigenous people and their land rights?
Well, I only will answer from the point of how much of land rights they've got, and I just gave you the facts and figures. So that gives you already an indication. I don't think those figures have changed much under the GTP, Government Transformation Program. And lives of indigenous people, they are still the poorest sector in Malaysia, in Semenanjung Malaysia, really Orang Asli. Then if you talk about the Orang Asal of East Malaysia, Sabah and Sarawak, the poverty, you saw the scenes of the photos coming during the elections. Road transport is bad, water is still not guaranteed, you know, their land is taken away by dams. So you have a whole list of issues, and then you wonder how would their lives change if their concept of life is not respected. And I think this is where the basic disjoint between government programming and them. And there are also many court cases now in both in Sarawak, Sabah and Semenanjung, where the Orang Asli and Orang Asal, the indigenous people, are actually challenging directly land ownership that has been stolen away from them via government titling.
We've been talking about Malaysians primarily, but now to turn our eye to people who are no less important, what is the situation for migrant workers in our country?
Okay, the figure says that we've got like what, 6 million migrant workers, government, you know, some ministers said, so 5 to 6 million, that's a lot. Both documented and undocumented. Of course, the word undocumented is what commonly people use, illegal. But mm-hmm. we believe no one is illegal in the world. Everybody is a human being. So their condition is still very vulnerable. No, and Malaysia has not ratified the convention. Even at the ASEAN level, it's one of the countries that are quite slow or regressive towards an instrument to protect migrant rights. And you and I know that a migrant worker who walks out feels very vulnerable, gets easily harassed by enforcement.
Anybody,
you know, even the person you want to buy, you negotiate. So you can speak to them in your own condominium or housing area, and you know how vulnerable they are. And any community is that vulnerable is open for exploitation. And I think the system of recruitment, the starting point recruitment agency from country, and now even the receiving end, I think there's a whole system that works to their disadvantage and making groups of people rich. And I think that's why there was a big reaction to that 1.5 million Bangladeshi workers recruitment. You know, people say, why, how come, what was the logic, rationale? And it was going to be done via a particular company. So then you times that number with the amount of per person, you realize it's a business. It's not actually answering the human labor need, you know. So I think from our point of view, this opens up to other exploitation, trafficking, sex trade. The whole works will happen because of the vulnerability of this community. And I think Malaysia needs to be a more responsible first world nation that it wants to be. You can't bring in 6 million people to work and don't afford them minimum wages and standards.
On that note about trafficking, of course, there are people who are going to be within our country's borders that didn't come here voluntarily or aren't staying here voluntarily. Yeah. And we were downgraded to Tier 3 of the U.S. State Department's Trafficking in Persons Report. What's being done to combat human trafficking and the corruption that happens within this?
So I think the downgrade has been public knowledge. And the government responded by a committee which includes two NGO representatives, which is a positive thing. Two NGO colleagues are in this. And I think they're trying their best to come out of this Tier 3. But I think the system needs an overhaul because, as we remember, the mass graves that were found in the border of Thailand, suddenly you realize, how is that possible when it's so close to everything? Then you wonder, where are the gaps in the system, you know? Who is closing their eyes or who is allowing people to walk through and do this? And if the overall system is not enhanced, there was questions of, was it because of corruption? Is it some parts of the police force that are taking some money or not? And this was mentioned by some top police person. So you need an audit. You need an independent body that can oversee enforcement. And that's why I want to bring here that the Bar Council of Malaysian NGOs is calling on the initiative of our former Prime Minister Badawi for the Police Commission, IPCMC, because you need an oversight body that is independent. And without that, you have this kind of problems. And I think trafficking is a systematic abuse that starts from the starting point right to the end. You know, Malaysians cried when we saw the Rohingyas and the boat people, but we only saw the boat people because there was some action to stop the flow of trafficking. if we do more of this enforcement and stopping, there will be no boat people who would either leave their country or forced to leave their country and exploit it at the end when they come to Malaysia or other countries. Yeah. So I think if you're looking at UPR, then Malaysian government, which is preparing for the 2018 report, will already get a hint at the questions of what they need to answer in 2018. And I think the world will be watching what's a serious commitment of Malaysia to anti-trafficking.
On that note, and to close off, because we've been talking about basically, you know, just all manner of human rights here in the country, is Malaysia on track to fulfilling its commitments?
I think no, in short, because there's still a lot to be done. And our check on monitoring Malaysian government the last 2.5 years has showed that most of the agreed recommendation that the Malaysian government has agreed publicly in Geneva has not been implemented or very slow progress. So very few has actually been implemented, no? And that issue of racial discrimination, even the National Harmony Act, was never really tabled and taken up. So I think if we go more detail, you realize that things are not looking good, and this is sort of an early warning bulb in the sea for Malaysia to prepare itself for 2018, but not for the reason of giving diplomatic answers, but actually it's an internal process for Malaysian people that the government of the day must take our rights seriously and want to do something rather than find convenient answers that they can speak of when they are in Geneva or New York.
I've been speaking today with Gerald Joseph, spokesperson for Komango, which is a coalition of Malaysian NGOs. We've been talking about their midterm report for the Universal Periodic Review and giving us just an overview of how we're doing in terms of human rights here in the country. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM.
You can get the report on Empower website, and you can read that fully, what we have said. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerald. You've been listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.